Hello, listeners. Welcome to a special episode of Standing Post. In recognition of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, we have joined forces with the Federal Bureau of Investigation to discuss what ransomware is and how it can affect you. This episode is a historic one for Standing Post, since it will mark the first time we have invited an outside federal law enforcement partner to join us on the show. Due to the length of the episode, we added a small intermission 24 minutes and 22 seconds into the show. So when you hear our show's theme music, that's your cue to hit the pause button and take a break if you need one. Now, please welcome to the show Special Agent Michael Moran and Supervisory Special Agent Jonathan Holmes. Gentlemen, I appreciate you coming on. This is a historic day for Standing Post. We have a really great topic to discuss today, but I think there was one important note I wanted to make is that I have two individuals from two separate agencies on the podcast, a first time ever. So I would like to actually give our guest first introduction, if you don't mind. Jonathan?
My name is Jonathan Holmes. I am a supervisory special agent with the FBI. I'm assigned to our major cybercrimes unit and our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Part of that role, I oversee many of our ransomware investigations, or I should say the strategy that the FBI has to investigate ransomware. I'm sort of driving that strategy from the FBI perspective and helping out all the ransomware case teams across the FBI to make sure that they have the resources they need and to make sure that we move those investigations forward with an optimal outcome.
Well, welcome to the show. Who do we have from the Secret Service?
Hey, everybody. This is Michael Moran with the Secret Service. I'm a special agent in the JIOC, which is a component of our criminal investigative division. The program desk, as we call it, that I'm kind of a member of is we call it the cyber-enabled desk, but it really kind of deals with intrusions and ransomware primarily. So what we do from kind of a headquarters level, kind of similar to Jonathan, is we manage the overall Secret Service posture and response to ransomware attacks and investigations, to make sure that all of our field offices and all of our agents in the field have the resources they need and also are being kept up to date with current intelligence that we're getting at the headquarters level.
Well, welcome to the show too, Mike. I appreciate you both coming on here to talk about, the topic of ransomware. But, I kind of always like to do a little bit of background with my guests so that the listeners kind of know where they're coming from and who they are and how they kind of came into their respective roles. Mike, I guess we'll start off with you. Where do you call home and how did you make your way into the cybercrime field and specifically to the point where you can talk about ransomware today?
Sure. Home for me originally is Chicago, Illinois. I spent most of my life there until college, but I've been in the DC area now for 12 years. So, DC and the area, the Northern Virginia area, is becoming more and more of a home to me, but still a fan of all of the Chicago sports teams. And in my mind still equates Chicago as home right now. As far as what got me into the cybercrime field, growing up, I'd always kind of been interested in computers. Didn't really know, back in the mid and late 90s that I could really make a career out of it. So went to college and got a business and accounting degree and a master's in accounting. But the whole time I kind of had, still a toe in the info systems world. I had a minor in info systems and also my master's degree also had a portion of it that was info systems oriented. I did some time in public and private accounting and then kind of got over to the law enforcement world. Before coming to the Secret Service, I did 5 years as a forensic accountant at the FBI, at FBI headquarters, splitting my time between the counterterrorism division, doing kind of follow the money type investigations, and then the cyber division. Once the cyber division over at the FBI was really kind of gaining traction and growing to kind of the behemoth that it is now, I was over there and helping them with some, virtual currency type stuff and really helping get the, the FBI cyber division as we know it kind of off on the ground and off running. Then I came over to the Secret Service and my first assignment was at the Washington Field Office, and I was a member of the Electronic Crimes Task Force, which now we have merged with our fraud task force and created the cyber fraud task force, because we realized that really every investigation has elements of financial and elements of cyber in it now. So the best bang for the buck for Secret Service resources was to merge those task force and to kind of have one unified approach to investigating cyber-enabled financial crime. I really enjoy being in the cyber field. It's a lot of work because you have to keep up on articles and listservs and, reading tons of stuff and studying. And it is a lot of work, but it's really fun. I don't really consider it work because I really do, as nerdy as that sounds, enjoy what I do.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us and, kind of telling your story and your background. I appreciate it. Jonathan, do you mind kind of giving us your background too for the listeners?
No, not at all. And I knew that I liked Mike for a reason because I've talked to him a bunch of times now, and I didn't realize until now that he was from Chicago. So that's fantastic because I moved around growing up, and although I didn't stay in one place too long, I claim Chicago is home because I went to high school and college there. So that's where I call home. I feel as though I'm a Midwesterner at heart, even though I'm in Washington, D.C. at the moment. But what got me into the cybercrime field in general is that I went to college for computer engineering. That's what my degree is in. And then after college, I was in the Air Force, served in the Air Force as an officer doing cyber stuff, we'll say. And while I was in the Air Force and working for them, I always had an interest in law enforcement because my family's in law enforcement. My dad was a federal law enforcement officer. Both my brothers are police officers. So I always had the itch for, to do something law enforcement related. And for me, that translated to applying to the FBI and ultimately getting assigned to the Los Angeles field office as my first office and working cyber cases there. So while I was in Los Angeles, I worked all kinds of cyber investigations to include national security cyber cases, criminal cyber cases. Towards the tail end of my career or my time in Los Angeles, I actually had the pleasure of supervising the cyber crime squad, the FBI cyber crime squad, which in Los Angeles is a little bit different. They are co-located with the Secret Service at the Secret Service's formerly Electronic Crimes Task Force. So it was a phenomenal experience for our two agencies working together. The Secret Service supervisors that I worked with on a daily basis, those guys were like brothers to me, right? I trusted them more than I trusted sometimes other people in the FBI and just had a great relationship working with them. And then fast forward, I served some time in our Madison, Wisconsin office for a couple of years. And for the last year now, I've been assigned to our headquarters, like I said, in our major cybercrimes unit.
Excellent, excellent. Well, again, Jonathan, thank you. I just want to say thank you for being, I guess you're honestly the first person too from outside the organization to be interviewed on Standing Post. So I greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come speak to the Standing Post listeners. So I appreciate it very much. So today's topic, we're going to be discussing ransomware. And so I really wanted to have you two gentlemen on to speak specifically about it because it's a prevalent, it's a crime that keeps, I think, getting a lot of news regarding what you see out there as far as cyber attacks and this malicious intent to basically lock up individuals' computers and to be able to demand ransom to get your information back. And so I was hoping maybe that you two, we can walk through it, kind of let the listeners know about it and what they can do to help maybe either mitigate the risks that they may have on their systems or be able to get help if they become a victim of ransomware. So again, I appreciate you coming on. So Mike, I'm going to toss it to you if you don't mind just kind of giving a general overview of ransomware to the listeners.
Sure, Cody. And your overview wasn't too far off, so give yourself a little bit of credit there. I've used this statement before in another panel with Jonathan, so this isn't new, but it went over well. I described ransomware as a violent crime against the computer network. It is such because it can cause just an extreme amount of damage that will take a lot of time and money to fix. So ransomware essentially gets onto a computer or onto a network and encrypts all the user's files, and possibly even the whole computer itself, and renders them inaccessible until a ransom is paid. It gets to the point where even if there are network backups and they're online and they're connected to the victim network, they also can be attacked and encrypted. And the violent part is that it's so overt, you know, because ransomware announces itself. So, you know, you either will get something toward like a company inbox, or even a screen will just pop up on the infected computers and nodes saying, hey, we are here. We have control over your whole network. We've locked down everything. The ticking clock starts going, counting down, and they demand payment in order to give back those files. So it is extremely destructive on a computer and network, possibly irreversible if not done properly, and just so overt, you know, that they announce their presence and they're boasting that they've got in there, and they're demanding, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of extortion money from these victim individuals and companies.
So do you mind maybe talking about like the evolution of where this started from? Because I know we often kind of joke about here, we mentioned a couple times on the podcast about like the Nigerian prince email scams and things like that. And that's kind of what I'm used to, because I can honestly say I haven't been a victim of this, and this isn't a challenge for anybody out there. But Jonathan, at the end of the day, you know, where is this coming from? Where was like the first incarnations of ransomware, and what did it look like?
Sure. Thanks, Cody. So yeah, this is I guess the question is more surrounding the history or the evolution of ransomware and where is it coming from. I'll start by just giving a general history of where we were and where we are now. The first modern day ransomware really started to come out around 2013 with the advent of CryptoLocker. And back then, CryptoLocker would encrypt an individual computer. So maybe you went to a malicious website, or you clicked on a link in an email, and malware got onto your computer. Your computer would get encrypted with malware, just like Mike described. Like, you can't access your files. And back then in 2013, that would happen to a single computer. And some ransom demands in those cases were really in like the hundreds of dollars range. So you'd have to get in touch with the bad guys. You'd have to pay them a few hundred dollars, and they would provide you decryption keys for your computer. Fast forward to 2015, we began to see a real sea change with the advent of SamSam ransomware. SamSam ransomware was different in that instead of it targeting that individual computer that's on a network, they targeted every single computer on a network. So they did this is the first of what we call these enterprise level attacks. And so now with these enterprise level attacks where every single computer within a network becomes encrypted, the ransom demands increased significantly. So we went from hundreds of dollars in 2013 to, after SamSam in 2015, we were talking about often tens of thousands of dollars. And then after 2015 to today, we've just seen a steady increase in new ransomware variants. And we've seen a steady increase in attacks. Bringing us to present day, we're probably tracking, I don't know, 15, 20 different really large, impactful ransomware variants. Obviously, there's lots more out there. But those ransom demands now have increased into the millions of dollars of range, and absolutely into the tens of millions of dollars range in some instances. So just for over the last 8 years, we went from hundreds of dollars, single computers being attacked, to sometimes ransoms being in the tens of millions of dollars with these enterprise level attacks.
Okay. Going back to tying it together to your Nigerian prince scam. Yes and no. So the Nigerian prince scam is kind of more like a romance scam and almost pure social engineering to develop a relationship to extort money. But that could be one of the many ways that infected piece of ransomware gets on a network. So you can use the social engineering aspect of those romance scams in order to persuade someone to go to a website, to click a link, to open a file attachment that then would go out and infect the computer or the network that computer is on.
Now, is there a primary person, specifically, what would be a primary perpetrator that you could identify, or is it just anybody and anyone who can get their hands on this type of software to program a ransomware, for lack of better words, ransomware program?
Primarily, these are perpetrated by financially motivated cyber criminals. So these are individuals whose primary motivation is to make money. We can see that with these large ransom demands. Obviously, these actors are also typically Russian speaking. They're typically located outside the United States, whether they're in Russia or Russian speaking countries or Eastern Europe. That's sort of a general theme that we see. But overall, I would just say, again, they're financially motivated. They're pretty indiscriminate in their attacks. They'll go after anybody because at the end of the day, their primary goal is really to make money any which way they can.
So, Mike.
Yeah, kind of as Jonathan mentioned, it is financially motivated. So it's anyone out there looking to make a buck. And ransomware has become an industry in its own right. There are software developers out there that will make ransomware and sell that via a commission to anyone to use to deploy to attempt to extort money from victims. So is it one person or larger groups working together? It's definitely not just one person, but it could be one person just by themselves doing a campaign or a coordinated effort between criminal enterprises, nation state enterprises, or just opportunist criminals. I could go out on the dark web and buy software that would enable me to then, go out and try to pass it along. And every $100 I get, I keep 80 and I kick 20 to the software developer. It's just become its own little business.
Yeah, and just to follow up on, what Mike was describing the groups, I think we, at our end of the FBI, we have, three sort of flavors or buckets that we put these ransomware variants into. And one is as Mike described, it's that service model where, I could go out on the internet and I can make contact with an individual and I can pay him for an executable, and that executable will encrypt victim computers. So there's that service bucket is one example of how these individuals are working together. And then there's another bucket, which we refer to as sort of the affiliate-based ransomware. And under that model, it's set up such that there is a developer or an individual we call the developer that develops the ransomware and develops the executables. And then he or she goes out and recruits affiliates. And so if I'm the developer in that scenario, I'm going to recruit a bunch of people to work with me. I'm going to call those people affiliates. And what those individuals are going to do is they're going to go out and they're going to gain access to victim computer systems. And once they get onto that computer system and they feel comfortable and they can deploy the ransomware, they're going to come back to me as the developer. I'm going to provide that executable to the affiliates. And then the affiliates are going to deploy the ransomware on that victim system. And then a ransom is going to be negotiated. And then the fruits of that ransom are going to be split between the developer and the affiliate. And so under that model, it's really beneficial for the developer because that individual can insulate themselves from the attack. And then it's also beneficial because you can really scale that ransomware up more, right? And so that's why that's one of the concerns that we have is why we see such an increase in ransomware attacks across the board, because a lot of the larger variants that we're seeing people get victimized, like Maze or like NetWalker, are falling into that affiliate-based category. So there could be lots and lots of victims because lots of individuals are working on the behalf of one particular variant. And then the third bucket would just be a closed group of individuals that are just working together. So it's not affiliate-based. It's just a handful of people that are working together that have developed a ransomware variant that are just working amongst themselves to gain access to victim systems and deploy the ransomware. So we have those three, at least in our minds, I keep it in those three buckets. It's that sort of like one-off, one guy or gal by themselves getting an executable from someone and doing a lot of the work and the deployment themselves, that affiliate-based model, and then that sort of closed group model when I think about the different groups.
And so, Mike, if you don't mind talking about maybe what is this all for? Why are these individuals doing it? I mean, you just provided like kind of what the hierarchies look like and the people behind this. Again, it could be anybody that either has an interest or is looking to make money through these types of programs, this malicious program. But like, what is it for? What are they trying to get? Is there some type of, because we talked about monetary payments to be made. Is that cash in hand? Is that virtual currency that's out there that I've heard a lot about? Can you kind of explain what these individuals are often using to help facilitate that transaction?
Yeah, absolutely, Cody. So, I mean, we've mentioned a few times the phrase financially motivated criminal. In general, you know, ransomware is designed to extort payments and create a revenue stream for those that are propagating it. I'm sure there are some people out there that just want to cause damage, like the anarchist that would be okay with just locking down computers and didn't necessarily care about getting payment. But at the end of the day, most everyone wants to get paid for their work. And yes, typically, I think we might have mentioned it, but as you just mentioned, virtual currency is the transacted currency that is required to hopefully get a decryption key to unlock your files. Virtual currency is a very big, broad category. The most common virtual currency is Bitcoin. That's kind of what, you know, a couple of years ago, even when your grandparents picked up a Wall Street Journal or something, called and asked you about what is this Bitcoin? Should I invest in it? So that's kind of the one that has the most name recognition. But essentially, Bitcoin and all of the other virtual currencies, they're unregulated digital currency. So they're only available electronically and usually created by very intelligent software developers. It's not backed, well, most of them, there are a few that have been backed by nation states. But most of them are not backed by any, you know, trust and faith in government. You know, unlike the dollar that, you know, is no longer backed by our gold reserve, but is backed by the creditworthiness of the United States. There's no underlying default stop behind virtual currency. So the value of virtual currency is purely derived through its scarcity and through the perceived market value of the virtual currency. So I did mention Bitcoin. A couple of the other popular ones are Ethereum and Litecoin. And what you've probably been seeing a little bit more in the news is Monero and kind of the more nefarious coins, if you will. Mm. So Monero and its ilk are essentially digital currency, the cryptocurrency that, unlike some of the other ones, that they're the general ledger of transactions on these currencies. So all of the ledger, like the bank statement, is available for anyone to look at online. So you can see, you know, that I paid Jonathan one Bitcoin or I paid Cody two Bitcoins, and that's in public. You don't see my name or Jonathan's name or Cody's name on there, but you can see the full transaction itself. What Monero has done is it obscured that ledger portion of it, so it is even harder to track and trace payments through that. So as law enforcement and analysts and intel shops have been getting better and better at tracking and tracing some of the more public ledger style virtual currency, a lot of these extortion payments and the criminal enterprises are relying on things like Monero that are a little bit harder to track and trace to give them a little bit more anonymity and in kind of recovering these payments. And criminals do want to use this because of its perceived anonymity. If you have some virtual currencies, you can go directly and convert them to fiat currencies like the US dollar or the euro. But you can actually surprisingly buy a lot of things for some of these virtual currencies direct. So it is a monetary instrument in the sense that enough of the open market has declared these valuable and has assigned a fluctuating price similar to a stock. But no real government has kind of labeled it as really official currency. You're not going to see, you know, the U.S. Treasury, you know, exchanging directly Bitcoin for dollars. But one wing of the Treasury is very interested in it, and that's the IRS. So while the United States does not officially recognize these virtual currencies as money instruments, they do recognize them as investment instruments, and they will be coming to get the long and short-term capital gains from buying and selling of these come tax time each year.
Let's talk about the people and who it affects and kind of like what we can do to maybe try to tell the listeners about how to identify if you are a victim of ransomware. You know, what does it look like? And, you know, is there at what point of the day or week or month or year can this occur? So, I mean, I guess, Jonathan, I guess if we can start with you on this one, can you, from your perspective or from your investigative work, who can this potentially affect out there in the world?
Short answer is really it could affect everyone. If we go back and we talk about the trend lines from ransomware, as I mentioned earlier, right? 2013, we're talking about those single computers, and a lot of the people that were being affected by it might just be everyday people like you or me on our home computers. But now that we've seen this transition where a lot of these larger variants are going after these enterprise level attacks, the answer is still it affects everyone, but it's less so at home on your home computer, and it's more so at your business or your place of work, where all of the computers within that organization are encrypted. So we've seen a bit of a change there. So still affecting everyone, but affecting you in a different environment or in a different place. And what we see with these ransomware actors when they're encrypting systems is that they're attacks aren't really so much targeted. I mean, if we're going to use the word targeted or say who is it affecting and what businesses, we don't see them necessarily going after a particular sector, like the healthcare sector or the banking sector. It really tends to be them targeting businesses or larger networks, and those attacks are opportunistic. So those attacks are going after these larger networks that have some sort of security flaw or some sort of hole or some sort of vulnerability that they could leverage to get access to those computer systems.
And Mike, is there like a real world example, something that you may have seen in your investigations of how this victimization can occur? Like maybe, you know, if you're able to share anything like that, but like something that you may have ran across or something that may have just surprised you that you didn't realize could happen or you've seen all the time?
Yeah, I mean, the attack vectors for ransomware are pretty similar. And as Jonathan said, it's definitely opportunistic. You're looking for a flaw. You're looking for something, a backdoor that's unlocked, a way to get in to not even steal the safe, but put another lock on the safe that would require someone to then pay to get access back to their safe. So typically the weakest link, unless it is just a poorly configured like network device, would be the human element. So you see a lot of the random phishing campaigns that are just an attempt to get someone to click on a link or to execute an executable, something that would provide that first, toe in the door. But then, as I mentioned before, you could have misconfigured network devices, and a lot of those, they'll be looking for standard configuration. So if someone put a device on the network, they would look, okay, did they even bother to change the password that came with it? Mm-hmm. Is it just admin 123, So that is, real easy ways to get in. And, certainly there are some, I would not say that this never happens. There are probably specific corporations or specific networks that are purely targeted because they want to cause havoc on that network. But that's a lot of work because you are constantly pinging and probing that network, trying to find vulnerabilities, working your social engineering angles to get someone to click on something. So it's a lot of work when there are a lot more, easier fish to catch that could also be equally as lucrative. So it's not really like there's any magic code to get this to happen. It's really just identifying either a human or a machine weakness and exploiting that and hopefully accomplishing your goal of locking everything down.
Is there a particular day or any time that this happens most frequently?
Well, I guess I can kind of answer that with a question to you, Cody. If you were, you know, going to rob a business, you know, when do you, if you knew they had, you know, people there and, you know, workers, when would you go in and try to, you know, break in that back door to steal the safe?
I guess when I knew they weren't going to be there. So holidays, things like that, or announced
exactly.
closures. Okay. No, that makes sense.
And that's exactly it. So, you know, typically the ransomware and the attackers will be in the network itself long before they execute the lockdown. They'll kind of probe and they'll kind of make sure that they've got all their tentacles out to impact the most systems. And what they will do a lot of the times is wait for the weekend or a holiday weekend, sometime when the IT staff, the IT security staff on hand is not at 100%. You know, it could just be someone on call over the weekend at home. So you can cause a lot of damage in, you know, 48 hours or even longer if you've got a 3-day weekend. And then, you know, when you return to work Monday morning or after the 3-day weekend, you know, that you can have it timed to have it, everything go locked down at 6 a.m. at that point. So that is, you know, definitely what they look for. Some attacks are even extra malicious and understand how business operates and how important month and quarter and year end time is for closing out of and creating financial reports. So they will get into the system and wait until they know they're at a quarter end or a month end or even the year end close, and then they'll lock down the system. And if you're talking about a publicly traded company that can't compile their financial statements, get them filed with the SEC in time to make their earnings report, you know, that is a significant amount of pressure then on that corporation to try to fix this as fast as possible. And often the quickest way to fix it is just to pay the ransom.
Well, I mean, I guess continuing this conversation, Jonathan, I'll ask you, is from what you've seen, do they stop there? And this can go for the question go both of you for both your investigations and what you've seen in the past. When they lock down your computer and you kind of go through the process and and we'll talk about a little bit later here on the show about what individuals can do when this happens to them, but you know, and you go through the motions and let's just say that you get to the point where you solve it, you get your system back, and it's done. Are those people that created that software, does it stop there? Is there anything else that would be on that system that could potentially do it again?
So in terms of like, do they stop there once they encrypt your files? I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, we talked about, again, the history of the evolution of ransomware earlier. And what I didn't mention is that what we really have seen over the last year is that not only are these actors gaining access to systems and encrypting the files on those systems, but before they do the encryption on the victim's computer network, they're exfiltrating or they're taking and copying data off of those victim networks. And so what we now see happening is, although the bad guys are going out and encrypting the computer systems, they're telling the victims, they're saying, hey, you know, clearly your computers are all encrypted, but also we have this extra leverage over you in that we have a lot of your sensitive data that we've taken off of your computer network. And if you don't pay us that ransom, not only will you be unable to decrypt your files, but we're also going to release a lot of the sensitive data that you have to the world. And so that's another leverage point that we see them using, or another pain point that we see for victims. Like, so the pain doesn't just stop when you come in and you into the office and you see that those computers are encrypted. It continues through the ransom demands and then the angst that a lot of victims are going to have, worrying about are their files going to be released to the world. But to answer your other question as well, do we see them come back and then re-encrypt a victim's computer system? We have on occasion. I would not say that that's the norm. With the number of ransomware variants that we have operating out there, we have seen companies fall victim to one particular ransomware variant. pay the ransom, get back on their feet, try and harden their computer systems to go 6, 8, 9, 10 months down the road, and then get hit by a different ransomware variant. But that speaks more to the lack of security of the particular victim than it does to the ransomware actors. But in general, it has happened on occasion, but in general, we don't see ransomware actors go back and retarget a victim that they've already targeted. And I think a lot of that is because in their minds, this is a brand, right? If a company falls victim to a particular ransomware variant, and they're considering paying millions of dollars to these actors, they want to be assured that these actors are going to be true to their word. So not only if they pay those millions of dollars, are the bad guys going to be able to provide decryption keys to the victim that will successfully decrypt their files, but also that they'll stay true to their word, that they won't come back and hit them again, and also stay true to their word that they won't release their files. And if any of these individuals or any of these ransomware actors, don't stay true to that word, then their brand diminishes. And in that sense, people will be less likely to pay them money, less likely to pay them money in order to decrypt their files or, again, ensure that their sensitive data isn't released to the world.
Is there anything else, like other consequences that could be potential that could result from a ransomware attack on a business or an individual?
As I mentioned above, it is a violent crime against the network. So while your network is locked down, you're not working. So in my example about trying to do a year-end close, like your accountants aren't working and compiling financial statements because they can't get on their computers. Your sales force can't sell. Your manufacturing can't track availability of product. That is a huge downtime risk for a company. And a publicly traded company, once you go out and if it leaks or if you announce that you've been hit, that could have a negative impact on your share price. People can perceive that as a weakness in your company. Your share price will take a dip, as we've seen in history. You usually get a dip and then it normalizes and comes back. But remediation is not cheap, and oftentimes your own internal IT department lacks the sophistication to really recover from an attack like this. So you're going out and you're having to pay a third party to come in. And, that is tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars of their time that you're spending. And these are huge expenses that you weren't anticipating taking. You really do have to do a cost-benefit analysis along the way. And, sadly, and going against everything that I speak for Jonathan a little bit here, that, Jonathan and I and law enforcement believe, we do not want anyone to pay the ransom, but we certainly understand when faced with the cost benefit analysis and looking at the totality of the circumstances, why some individuals and corporations do decide to pay the ransom. It's just more fiscally prudent for them and they can get back up and running faster. So, While we see that as a loss, the company itself, they just want to get back to selling the product and closing the books and normal business operations. Whereas we want, if in a perfect world, if an attack like this happened, we would want everything to stop. We would want to bring in all of our forensic guys and pull as much evidence as we could, get the logs, get to find the variants that we can and kind of deconstruct that. But that's a considerable amount of time for these companies to not be doing what they're supposed to be doing and selling the product.
Something to add as well, like Mike hit the nail on the head, right? Like it's the loss of critical work from these businesses. It could be the loss of their credibility. If they're a large corporation, they might not want the public knowing that they've been victimized by ransomware. And that's huge on the remediation costs. So a victim... That the remediation cost cannot be understated, because a victim, it's not just they're paying to get their computer systems back up and running. They also have to determine the data that's lost from their network. So many companies have reporting obligations. So if they lose customer data, they have to notify their customers. And so there has to be, as part of that remediation process, they also have to try and identify, especially now that we know ransomware actors are stealing data from computer networks, to determine Was any data taken? If it was, what was the data taken? Are there reporting requirements? So that remediation just grows and grows. And then just to echo Mike's point, you know, we do not, just to be very clear, we do not advocate paying the ransom. But Mike said perfectly, we could understand their position. And just a personal story for me, when I was working with a victim while I was in the field, their company was hit by ransomware, and the attackers demanded $500,000 in payments in order for the victims to decrypt their systems. And I had this conversation with the victim where they're saying, well, Jonathan, what should we do? Should we pay the ransom? Should we not pay the ransom? And of course, I told them, you know, it's FBI's official position not to pay. And they said, look, you know, at the end of the day, this demand is $500,000. And we are losing $500,000 a day. And so as we look towards the future, we could pay this ransom, decrypt our files, and then hopefully be back up and running within the week. Or we could try and rebuild our systems and replicate our data, and that might take us a month. So when they approached this from purely a business decision, I can understand that business decision to say, hey, like on a purely cost basis, it might be cheaper for us to just pay and move on. Again, I will say that we do not advocate paying the ransom, but I could absolutely understand that position.
What do I do as a victim of ransomware?
So I'll kind of answer this question. This is Mike. I'll kind of answer this question broadly and speak for both an individual and a business and kind of interchange the list as we go. But there are a number of calls that you would want to make right away. And Jonathan and I would highly recommend contacting law enforcement early in the process, because there are things that we want to get from the system before remediation is done. There are resources that we have to help too. We're not going to be the ServPro crew coming in and cleaning up everything, but you know, we want to be there when your cleanup crew is there, because they will be working hand in hand with us and probably pulling some of the forensics that we need directly from the systems as they're cleaning. So contact law enforcement early in the process. Any systems in your network that you have that are not showing signs of the ransomware, attempt to isolate those to protect them. And then verify and protect your backup, both online and offline. So like, as I mentioned earlier in this discussion, your online backup could possibly be victimized. But if you do have good network segregation, there is a chance that those will be safe. You wouldn't want to start that backup process right away, because that would just be opening the door to possibly get that area infected. So verify that those are safe. If they are, and you do not already have an offline backup, that might be a really great time to make an offline backup, because that will be, you know, the kind of the keys to the kingdom right there. From a company's perspective, and possibly even from like a high net worth individual, you might want to call your lawyer, get your internal or external counsel aware of this, because they might want to be involved. Cyber insurance and even insurance against ransomware attacks is becoming more and more of a thing. So if you do have a cyber insurance policy, you want to call your insurance vendor. And they could very well, as we've seen, take over the whole process themselves. So you pay, you know, an insurance vendor for this cyber insurance, and they will be the ones that coordinate remediation. And they will be the ones that reach out to law enforcement. So they have the playbook there. So if you do have one of those policies, they're, you know, one or one A or B that you need to call to let them and notify them, because they know the steps to go through to try to help you as much as possible.
What I can do for the listeners out there is to be able to provide in the show notes the contact information to be able to start that process with law enforcement officials. So the numbers will be available for both the FBI and the Secret Service there. So I guess, Jonathan, I want to ask you, what is the FBI doing, kind of like a community outreach? Is there anything that the FBI is doing to help out the American people regarding ransomware or even cyber attacks in general?
With regards, I'll sort of answer this in two parts, right? Is what are we doing for ransomware in general, and what are we doing to interact with the community? It's probably easiest to say what are we doing with ransomware in general first. And I would say that we have sort of three main priorities. One is obviously to hold these bad guys accountable, right? And we do that by doing what law enforcement does best, is we investigate who's doing this and we try and bring them to justice, right? We try and arrest them. If they're outside the U.S., try and bring them back here and put them in jail. Obviously, that can be very difficult when these individuals are hard to reach. So we also try and target them in other ways. We try and target their money by seizing that money, either through criminal or civil seizures. We try and sanction them when appropriate, so that makes it even more difficult for them to receive money. And we try and take down the infrastructure that they're using by working with our public and private partners. So the first vein would be holding these individuals accountable. The second vein would be to target the criminal ecosystem. And that just means ransomware actors are reliant on a lot of other services to perpetrate these attacks. So an example would be their reliance on shady virtual currency exchanges. And so if we identify some of these virtual currency exchanges that are illegal or illicit, we target them with investigations and try and shut them down. And we've done a really good job with that, I believe, working with our partners in the Secret Service, going after exchanges like Coin.mx or BTCE, where we target these marketplace sites. An example would be the Ecstatic marketplace sites, where we know ransomware actors were going to this particular site and they were purchasing remote desktop protocol credentials, which they would then leverage to gain access to victim computer systems and then deploy ransomware on those systems. And then the third vein would be doing outreach and education. And then this speaks to our interaction with the public, right? So we try and educate the public by doing podcasts like this, or providing briefings to the general public. And we do a lot of outreach to victims to help them, prepare ahead of time. So we do that through our InfraGuard program, which is a program where we make contact with all large companies in each of our 56 field offices. So we try and have relationships with large and small businesses across the United States in that fashion. We also, as part of the ransomware effort, have regular contact with private industry. So an example of that is we just had a ransomware summit about 2 weeks ago, where we brought heads of industry from the insurance industry to incident response to get in a room virtually during times of COVID for a week to talk about how to best target ransomware actors and how best to have an effect in the space. We're also having conversations with the insurance industry regularly to see how the FBI can assist them to help ensure that their clients are best securing their computer systems. So across the board, whether it's a small business, large business located across the country, we're trying to do outreach to them to help ensure they're aware of the threat and make them more knowledgeable. And then similarly, at the national level, we're trying to work through with our industry partners to have an effect on these ransomware actors as well.
And thank you, Mike. I guess the same question for the Secret Service.
The Secret Service and the FBI, having spent time with both agencies. There are a lot of things that we do different, but there are a lot of things that we do the same. And, I think that we are pretty similar in our efforts to combat ransomware and other major kind of cyber financial crime, and all the way up to and including the outreach. So, we this is the second time in 4 weeks that Jonathan and I have talked on a platform similar to this, discussing this threat, getting more word out there about what you can do to be proactive and to update your networks and update your patch, your system patches. The more proactive we are, the less work we have on our criminal investigative side. So it's in our best interest to be as proactive as possible, to go out and do the education part and ensure that the victim pool is as small as it can be. We will still go, full on investigations if anything does happen, but we, all of our field offices, the larger ones, we have our cyber fraud task force, and we do quarterly meetings, and we have the cyber fraud task force is comprised of state and local and federal law enforcement, and we also do outreach to corporations and districts. So the effort is to get everyone, meeting quarterly, just going over a couple firm topics on the agenda, and then kind of having an open discussion of things that have been noticed and witnessed, and you know, where we can help. You know, the federal government itself has a lot of resources at its disposal. You know, the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security have a lot. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, MDHS, CISA, they do a lot of proactive work to meet with corporations and infrastructure stakeholders and help them go and do physical and cyber assessments. You know, it's free. The taxpayer is funded. They will go out. They will do, you know, anything up to even an in-depth, lengthy penetration test on a network and a facility, or just a, you know, as routine as just talking over roughly what your cyber hygiene. So there, the federal government does have a lot of assets out there. You know, it kind of reminds you of that commercial you would see late at night when we were all growing up about the, you know, the guy that was waiting in the reflecting pool outside of the Lincoln Memorial in his suit covered with question marks, talking about all of the grants that the United States government had that were unused, and, you know, contact me now and I can tell you, you know, where you can get free money. Well, there are a lot of resources. I mean, that guy was right 20-some-odd years ago. You know, there are a lot of resources that our tax dollars pay for, and time and expertise, and a lot of talented individuals that work in the federal government that are, you know, wanting to help, you know, be proactive and wanting to help you recover from a bad situation.
I appreciate you both being on the show, because that I wanted to emphasize the partnerships that we have between federal partners regarding ransomware and then cyber attacks in general, because I know we work together to make sure that we're taking down the bad guys when this stuff occurs. So Jonathan, I want to turn to you as our first official guest from an outside agency. Do you have anything that you want to tell the listeners?
I would just leave the listeners with, you know, I think the FBI and definitely the government and law enforcement in general recognize that ransomware is a real concern. And these attacks are expected to increase, and these ransom demands are expected to increase. And we recognize that, and we are doing our best to target these individuals in any way we can, whether that's, again, indictments or sanctions or seizures. And it is our hope and my belief that although we, with these larger variants that have come out over the last year, that we haven't had any major charges against these individuals. The last big case that we can point to were the SAMSTEM charges at the end of 2000, I think that was 18. And with those are the last major charges we had in a large ransomware case. And I would expect to see a lot more charges over the next 6 months to a year. So I would say don't think that we're not doing anything. We're definitely working diligently behind the scenes, very, very hard. Expect to see some results in the near future.
And Mike, I'll turn it to you. Is there anything that you want to tell the listeners before we close out the episode?
Yeah, well, first off, Jonathan, thank you for coming into the Secret Service podcast and sharing all of your insight from you and from the FBI. It's always great working with you on this. But just for the listeners to know, Jonathan and I don't just talk to each other through these things. We also work with each other, and we talk with each other about investigations and about ransomware trends and themes. So I know one question we get a lot is, you know, who do we call when we are victimized? And, you know, the answer is just call whoever you feel comfortable with. If you have working relationship with someone from Secret Service, call them. FBI, call them. If you've got a cousin that is on a local police department, give them a call, because eventually it'll get to the right people. And we'll get everyone working on it together. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, do your Windows updates and keep your network devices at home and at the office as up-to-date as possible. Just hope that it's not you. But if it is, don't panic and, you know, give us a call and we'll help you.
Special Agent Michael Moran and Supervisory Special Agent Jonathan Holmes, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cody.
For more information or how to report a ransomware attack, please go to www.secretservice.gov or fbi.gov. And until next time, listeners, stay vigilant.